And time for our Wednesday history lesson. A long out-of-print book of legends and stories from the Yakima Nation is back in a new edition. The author, who grew up in a native language-speaking household, has been studying indigenous languages since she was 12. She has now reached age 100, and our resident historian Felix Bunnell recently spoke with her. Felix is brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning, Felix.
Yeah, good morning, Dave. Yeah, this is a 100-year-old author. She's an expert on this language called Sahaptin. And that's the language that was spoken in many different dialects all across what's now eastern Washington. Now, the author of the book is Virginia Beavert, but that's not her only name.
My Indian name is Tuchamshish. I'm Virginia Beavert.
You know, and she's leading an amazing life. She's done so much to preserve and share language, culture, and history of the original inhabitants of the Columbia Plateau, maybe more than anyone else. She was born in 1921, grew up in the Yakima Valley with parents and grandparents who spoke many tribal dialects and languages that she learned to speak as well. And Virginia Beavert started early in her linguist career. She helped document the Klickitat language for a researcher from Dartmouth when she was only 12 years old. She helped actually create a written version of that language as a 12-year-old. She raced horses. She served in the Air Force during World War II at a B-29 base as a radio operator in New Mexico. And then about 50 years ago, with encouragement from her family and some grant money from the early days of kind of self-determination and Native education, along with the American Indian movement back in the late 60s, she spent most of a year driving up and down eastern Washington in her Dodge from Wenatchee to Celilo, making audio recordings of stories and legends told by elders to be used to create a book to be used in classrooms on the Yakima Reservation. Now, it was unusual for Native people to allow themselves to be recorded, but Virginia Beavert was trusted, and she found many willing narrators.
When I explained the project, the way it was explained to me, they said, all right, I will record some legends for the children, for their education. And I thought that was very open-hearted about them. And I told them how much I appreciated that they didn't turn me out the door.
Now, the book is called Anaku Iwacha, which means The Way It Was. It was published in 1974 as a resource for Yakima Nation schools. But it became priceless for anyone interested in indigenous culture and eastern Washington history. One of the cool things about it is that many of the legends and stories relate to specific landmarks. And Virginia Beavert says that presents a unique opportunity to transmit history and values to children and to adults.
They take them there to these landmarks and talk to them about the legend and tell the beautiful parts about it. And also, if you have to relate some of the hard lessons, then do it gently. They had a way of putting this across to their children so that it didn't frighten them, you know.
You know, and there are specific places referenced in the stories, such as Beacon Rock along the Columbia River.
It was bare, and it represented the conceited young man who rejected these younger maidens in a disrespectful way, and he also hurt them. And all the lessons that were in that, don't hurt other people, don't insult them like you did, and be gentle with your playmates and all a whole bunch of things. You'll have to read it. And then go to Beacon Rock, and you'll remember that legend.
That universality that's pretty cool, like these sort of, I don't know, the morality tales or stories that have a moral or a lesson to them. I mean, it's true in any culture and cultures that have been in this area for 8,000 years. One of the editors in the new edition is Dr. Michelle Jacob. She's a member of the Yakima Nation and a professor of Indigenous Studies at the University of Oregon. She says the impact of Anaku Iwacha, you know, the original edition, goes far beyond the Northwest.
And I've been at international education conferences where I've heard experts, you know, talking about culturally responsive curriculum, and they pointed to the first edition of Anaku Iwacha as that wonderful model that other communities look to. So that's, you know, just a credit to Tuchamshish and to everyone that she worked with.
You know, in that original edition, it was a relatively small run. It's been like mimeographed versions of it. It comes up every now and then on online booksellers for hundreds of dollars. So it's pretty cool that's out now from University of Washington Press. Virginia Beaverett's justifiably proud of this new edition of the book. She's encouraged that younger generations will do their part to preserve the stories and legends, but also, as she's been doing for literally almost all her life, preserving indigenous languages.
The young people now are beginning to realize their culture is also disappearing, because without culture, there's no language. Without language, there's no culture.
You know, and those tapes that she made 50 years ago, those were stolen. They disappeared. So she translated all the stories and legends into English, but she'd recorded them in all those original dialects, and the tapes, they were stolen sometime in the mid-1970s, have never been seen ever since.
Wow.
If those ever turned up, they would be just absolutely priceless. And the book's called Anaku Iwacha. It's got these incredible illustrations. Back when she was doing the original edition, she put a poster up at the tribal center there in Toppenish, I think. It said, if anyone wants to contribute drawings. So multiple tribal people drew their own pictures to go along with these legends and stories. And those are reproduced in this new edition of the book, too. So,
and that's
just
out
a
now?
Really cool. What's that?
Is it out now?
Yeah, it's out now. And it's, you know, there's sort of a ghettoization of history. Sometimes you have European history, African-American history, Native American history. This is just Northwest history. It just should be on the bookshelf there with any other story about stuff that's happened here in the Northwest, because it's 8,000 years of amazing culture that's right here from where we all live.
Yeah. I mean, can you find it on Amazon?
Yeah, it's published by University of Washington Press, and it's a gorgeous book. You can probably get it at the university bookstore. I'm sure it's available lots of places.
Felix Bedell, every Wednesday and Friday on Cairo News Radio. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And joining us now from 710 ESPN is the host of the Mike Salk Show, Mike Salk himself. I thought we'd ask you, first of all, about the Hall of Fame voting, which I guess is wrapped up for this year?
Yeah, it came out yesterday afternoon, and only one Hall of Famer this year, David Ortiz, Big Poppy. Incredibly deserving, I believe, of the Hall of Fame. If you look at his numbers in the regular season, they are Hall of Fame worthy. But when you add in what he did in the postseason, I mean, being the MVP of the series where the Red Sox finally took down the Yankees in 2004 and then won the World Series after 86 years, he carried his team to another World Series victory in 2013. That doesn't even include what they won in 2007. He was one of the ultimate postseason players, clutch players, walk-off hitters, in addition to just being a great hitter and a pretty great person to be around. I had the privilege of covering him for a few years, and he was wonderful to the media, wonderful to be around. And his signature moment of all things, Dave, is somewhat radio related.
Yes.
As after the Marathon bombing in 2013, you may remember they finally got back to Fenway Park, which is a pretty relevant place to the marathon, as it usually wraps up as right at Fenway Park in Kenmore Square. And David Ortiz said, "This is our bleeping city." And he didn't bleep himself. Nobody bleeped him. And later the FCC said, "We stand with Big Poppy," which doesn't happen very often.
No,
usually the FCC
right.
doesn't like that kind of thing. But in this case, they came out in favor of David Ortiz, which I thought was just a very telling moment about who he was.
Yeah. Well, smart move. And he's the only one who got in?
Yeah. And I think that's ridiculous. Barry Bonds, who's probably the greatest player in baseball history, did not get in, certainly by the numbers he is, because of the steroid allegations.
Yeah.
And he most certainly used them. I read Game of Shadows. Roger Clemens did not get in, despite being one of the best pitchers of his era. I think it's ridiculous. I understand that the guys cheated, but so did so many players of that era. So did players who are in the Hall of Fame in other ways as well. So I think it's a terrible system that they have with the writers voting, and many of the ballots are anonymous. And hopefully this will be some sort of an impetus to change.
That whole issue sort of dropped out of the news. So what was the final verdict on whether, because I remember people saying, okay, maybe they use steroids, but you, Dave, even if you use steroids, could not possibly have performed the way they did. So there was some skill involved, despite.
Well, sure, both of those things were true. Barry Bonds was the best player in baseball before he took steroids. Then other people started taking steroids and passed him. And he said, "Hey, I want to still be the best player in the game, so I'm going to start taking even more roids than they're taking." And then he became the best player in the game again at a just otherworldly superhuman level. So, no, can it turn you, Dave, into the best ball player of all time? No, but it can take a major leaguer.
Wait a second, have you seen me hit?
Well, no, I've seen you do other things. I've seen you walk around the office. I don't think you're going to hit the ball like Barry Bonds.
Okay, let's talk about the MLB lockout. That would be terrible. I mean, this is the season the Mariners are supposed to really perform, right?
Yeah, this is a year they get good. Maybe not great. I don't know whether I'm like predicting a World Series for them or anything yet. And we still don't know how they finish off their offseason. But they should be a good team this year and really start getting into contention and an expectation level that is playoff bound. And unfortunately, right now, that's been stymied by this baseball lockout. There has been some good news in the last couple of days. The sides are starting to feel the deadline. I think they'd like to get it wrapped up if they can by February 1st. That would give them a full 2 weeks to get everybody into spring training on time and then start games March 1st. Realistically, they've got some wiggle room before they have to lose spring training games, and even more before they would have to lose actual major league, you know, regular season games. But the good news is they're actually talking. They didn't talk for like a month and a half, and then they, you know, the first time before that, they talked for 7 minutes.
What's the
and
big
then
issue?
Walked out.
What's the
oh my gosh,
the
economics of the game, they really should be completely overhauled. I mean, without getting too into the deep, deep woods, you know, players right now can become a free agent after 6 years. The players wanted that to be 5 years. There's issues with arbitration, which are years 4, 5, and 6, where you can start to make a little bit more money. There are issues with the major league minimum for rookies, which right now is around $570,000, and they want it to be $775,000.
What about parity? What about
they want to try to do things for parity? Yes.
Yeah.
The league says that they have a, you know, a threshold, a tax threshold. So when the top teams who spend the most money reach that threshold, they get taxed. And the players want that number to go up because they want more money in the pool for the players, and they don't want the Yankees and the Dodgers, et cetera,
right,
to not spend that money. So what the players want isn't necessarily great for competitive balance, but it's good for them. On the other hand, the players want the teams at the bottom who are taking the most money in revenue sharing and aren't spending it, they're just pocketing it, to spend more of it. So they have all kinds of problems. They're probably not going to fix any of them. They're just going to end up making some tweaks. And when all is said and done, hopefully we get baseball on time.
Well, do you think any of these changes would improve the game and, you know, make it more like the NFL where everybody has a decent chance of winning?
I think that would be wise, but I don't think it'll ever happen. The Players Association in baseball is just so much more powerful than the NFL one. As you know, I mean, one of the really more powerful unions in the country, and, you know, what started in the 70s with, you know, Andy Messersmith and the entire baseball strike that took place then, it really has changed the way those two sides negotiate. The players just have more power than they do in other sports. They will never accept a salary cap like the NFL has, and because of it, baseball will never be as competitive.
Mike Sauk, 710 ESPN. Thanks, Mike.
See ya.
It looks like the legislature wants to get tough on the shady practices being used in some assisted pregnancies, and there are new training requirements for law enforcement and prosecutors handling sexual assault cases. Let's go to Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott with the latest legislative highlights. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, we'll start off with the shady practices in assisted pregnancy. So we're talking about all of the different ways of people getting pregnant that is not the traditional way, in vitro and the various other methods that are used at fertility clinics. And it's a problem that is growing that has led to some really, really harsh discoveries for people about their family, about their who their parents are, about how long their donations were used. People, you know, using their donations of sperm or egg longer than were supposed to be used, and in areas of the country where they were not supposed to be used. Representative Tina Orwell is behind this bill. She explains it a little bit more in detail.
Imagine growing up, you have two wonderful parents that are raising you, and you find out that, you know, your father is not your biological dad. It is actually the fertility doctor. And, you know, I just can't even imagine the trauma and shock this causes. And I would tell you this is an isolated case, but they're finding them all over the country. There is one fertility doctor that may be associated with as many as 60 cases. You know, this is unethical. This is a violation of a woman's body. This is so deceptive. And one of the disturbing things I have learned is that most of these doctors still have their license.
So this bill would crack down and make any kind of lying of when you run a fertility clinic or a practitioner of somebody who does this kind of work, if you misrepresent anything, lie in any way to the patient, it would be a misdemeanor. And then it creates a felony if you do the scenario like she just described there, where you're the fertility doctor and use your own material to impregnate someone without their written consent. The other issue that's been coming up and why the falsifying of or lying is an issue is these kind of scenarios.
Imagine you're a donor. And you're told that they're going to cap the use of your biological materials to find out they didn't. And they didn't send it to the East Coast, but they kept it in your area. And you live in Portland and you're surrounded by 13 children that you actually were part of creating. And, you know, some of these in the Portland area were friends. Now, I was adopted, Mr. Chair, and luckily I had the good fortune of meeting my family a number of years ago. But growing up, if someone told me I looked like I was related to somebody I was dating, it was horrifying. When you don't know who your relatives are.
So those both of those scenarios are happening more and more often. There's not a lot of regulation here, and it's not just in other parts of the country. There are multiple cases here as well, including from Tracy. This is why Representative Orwell actually introduced this bill. She got a call from this woman who lives in Washington. Her name's Tracy.
Years ago, my parents' fertility doctor told them he would use sperm from a pre-med student to help my father's sperm along for conception and convinced my parents to tell no one of the procedure. Fast forward to 2019 when I was looking into genetic medical issues for me and my children, and I took an over-the-counter DNA test. The results showed not only was I donor conceived, but that my biological father was my mother's fertility doctor, Dr. Gary Vandenberg of San Diego, California, who used his own sperm without my parents' permission. Finding out all of this was absolutely devastating. I felt like I've tumbled into a black hole with no footholds and no knowledge of how to piece back together who I am, where I belong, or how I fit into this world.
Another Seattle woman speaking on behalf of herself and others who have experienced issues with this.
I struggle on a daily basis.
She said that the other Seattle woman says that she actually found out she was, until she was 44 years old, thought she was half black. Turns out she wasn't. So there's identity crisis issues, things like that. So that is the gist of the bill. It got a hearing and a lot of support yesterday. We'll see what happens next. And as far as the prosecutor's training goes on sexual assaults, this is something we've covered in the past. This is a proposed bill, again, from Representative Orwell. We had previously seen her pass a bill that required training specifically for detectives that investigate sexual assaults. It's trauma-informed training to make sure you know how to speak to your various people who have been victimized by sexual assault. This would expand that to include all police as well as prosecutors. And there's some emotional testimony I'll share with you momentarily, but this is Ben Santos. He is the head of the Special Investigations Unit over at the King County Prosecutor's Office and says this is absolutely a necessary thing.
We realize that there's this real need to make sure that we have meaningful and consistent training for prosecutors who are coming into this work with less experience, knowing that these are some of the most complex cases that we try.
And he's talking about several instances where there's just not been enough of the trauma-informed training, where you're not sensitive enough, because it's very difficult for sexual assault survivors to come forward. And we heard from Leah, I can't get the audio to work right now, but we heard from Leah Griffin, who's been really a key member of getting the backlog rape kits tested and part of that task force that the Representative Orwell works with. And basically she shared for the first time her own experience after being raped in 2014, where she was working with the King County Prosecutor's Office. She pushed to try to get charges and to try to get things done. It was a date rape situation where she had been drugged and there was evidence that she had been drugged. But the prosecutor she worked with at the time told her, she shared yesterday, that while it might be morally reprehensible to rape a drunk woman, it is not a crime. If you continue to talk to the media about this, we will have to let people know about your behavior. Wow. And various other things like that.
She was threatened?
Yes, that's exactly what she said. She closed her testimony by saying that's why we need this type of rule and this training, so that not only you have the sensitivity and the training that is necessary for trauma-informed, but to end this kind of culture of threats and that kind of situation. I mean, that was only 2015, actually. She was raped in 2014. Those comments came in 2015 when she pushed for action.
Well, the other issue that I'm sure people want to get an update on is tax relief. Any progress there?
There's been lots of hearings, and I don't see, I will say this, we're hearing a lot of different bills and a lot of, testimony, support and against. Those are going to be budget related issues, so there's not going to be, subject to the policy cutoff, which is next week, so they've got a little more time. I think mm-hmm. there is a legitimate appetite among some in the leadership to get some sort of tax relief. I think you're most likely to see what we talked about yesterday, which is the, tax holiday. Maybe, but even that one hasn't been scheduled for a vote yet.
The tax holiday, just to explain, would be like a 1 year reduction just until that, at least part of that surplus is gone. Because this is the concern, I guess, is this is just a one time surplus, not something.
Right, a good chunk of it is one time surplus, mm-hmm. is what the what's what they're saying. So they don't want to get for instance, Mona Doss's 1% sales tax across the board cut would be problematic because that's an ongoing thing. And then of course Linda Wilson and the Republican side had the very lengthy cutting all kinds of taxes, property taxes, and capital gains, doing away with all of
that. But the sales tax thing does have Democratic support.
It has it's a Democratic bill. That's from Senate Democrat Mona Doss.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So we'll see.
Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Very good. And here I am on standby with a daily dose of kindness. Sorry I can't be there for all of you guys. This is sponsored by Heritage Homecraft, a Las Vegas school principal who goes above and beyond. Really, he got a surprise of a lifetime. Oh, you need to hear him, don't you? Here you go.
I need to do my part, and I've always worked like this in all the school stops that I've been to.
His part? In light of staffing shortages, he's not just the principal.
We've helped out in the cafeteria. I've done janitorial, custodial work, vacuuming, cleaning toilets.
Principal Joseph Uy tells KBTS-TV he will not hesitate to do any job at Woolley Elementary School. Says he's just doing his part to keep the school open during the pandemic.
I might have the P on the door, the principal, but my job is to serve my staff, my kids, my community.
And his hard work paid off in an unexpected way. A surprise from the Las Vegas Raiders.
I would love to surprise you with 2022 Super Bowl tickets to L.A.
And Uwe's reaction.
I just lost it. And I was speechless. And I'm never speechless.
He says the drive to go above and beyond comes from his Filipino upbringing and the humility that's ingrained in his family.
My parents both have raised us to be respectful. Be respectful of people. Be respectful of the job that you have. Be thankful.
And adds he's not the only principal in the school district taking on many roles. He's just the one being recognized now.
7:48. And now from the G and Ursula Show, which starts at 9 o'clock, here is G. Scott. I'm a little late to this story, but I was reading up about John Stockton, NBA Hall of Famer, alum of Gonzaga. I sent two daughters there, so we are Gonzaga fans. Mm-hmm. And because he did not want to wear a mask to the games that he attends, they've now basically declared him persona non grata at the gym. What's behind all this?
The wearing of the mask. John Stockton did not want to wear a mask at their basketball games. And so he got a letter and notice that there were some fans that had complained about him not wearing a mask. Now, I would assume that when John Stockton shows up to a game that people actually know who he is. Yeah. And I think the fact that him not wearing a mask is what got folks saying, hey, wait a minute, he's not wearing a mask, but we have to wear a mask. And I think that that was what sounded the alarm. And then obviously John Stockton doesn't want to do it. So Gonzaga says, all right, well, if that's the case, we're going to suspend your tickets. And I've said all along, like, wow, I'm actually surprised that they took that stance, and good for them for doing that. They're basically saying, look, we know, John, that you are our most celebrated alumni ever, but we can't have this. So kudos to them.
Well, and also ushered in an interview with the Spokesman Review in which he started, talking about these debunked and unproven COVID theory. So it wasn't just about the mask. Now it's about his ideas around the virus. Like, he hasn't been vaccinated. He claimed without evidence that more than 100 professional athletes have died after receiving the vaccine. I mean, he is spreading false information following this incident, and the newspaper's printing it. So it's more serious than just, I don't want to wear a mask. It is, he has decided, he's so anti-vaccine that they asked him, well, even the Pope, because this is a Jesuit Catholic university, they said, well, even the Pope says we need to do our part and do this for humanity. And he's like, well, sometimes our leaders let us down. And I'm like, whoa. So I was curious about Dave's reaction to that, like going against the Pope.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what really stands out to me about this. Now, John Stockton, who, I mean, one of the greatest basketball players of all time, one of the greatest point guards of all time, all that stuff, we can go on for days about John Stockton. And so I was thinking about this. I'm like, I grew up a basketball fan, know exactly who he is, followed his career and everything. I can't think of any other interviews that he's done. He's a quiet guy. He's not one that talks a lot. And I was thinking, like, this interview, I'm like, man, this dude stays quiet about everything. You don't never see him in the news. You don't ever hear about anything. But he's so vocal about this. And which, by the way, I'm going to say this. I don't think the problem is his opinion on the vaccine or his stance on getting the vaccine or whether or not people should wear masks. I think this all is very simple. Gonzaga says, that's cool, but when you come to a basketball game, you have to wear a mask.
Yeah.
That's it. It's not about his philosophy, his ideas, none of that. Just wear the mask.
Yeah. I mean, I don't care about, in terms of your question about how Catholics feel about this, there are some more conservative Catholics who feel that because the vaccine was apparently tested on cells that were obtained from fetal cells, that their faith prohibits it. The Pope has poo-pooed that, but Catholics, of course, are not ordered to follow what the Pope says.
What is that? What is it about? Like, you have a church leader, you have a church, you ask for that church leader and, you know, to weigh in, and he or she does, and you still, I guess it's good that you're still making up your mind anyway, but
called free will, Colleen.
I get it. But it's like, if you can pick and choose when you listen to the leaders of your religion, what's the point? What's the point in not going, huh, a majority of my church that follows my religion says this. I just feel like I know better and I'm going to leave the flock and do it on my, like,
yeah. Well, you'd
religion
have to,
is groupthink, right? Religion is groupthink.
You'd have to ask him what's going on in his mind. But I agree with you. This is kind of a strange hill to die on, right?
Yeah.
Just, you don't want to wear a mask in public with other people around. I'm curious, do we know if the complaints were about people worried that he might infect them or just that it was a crummy example?
Well, it's a mandate at the university.
I think it's one of those things. I think it's one of those things like, yo, hold on. I don't want to. I think there's some people in there that's like, look, I don't want to wear this mask.
Uh-huh.
And if I'm at this basketball game and I got to wear this mask, but John Stockton don't have to wear his mask.
Yeah.
Oh, we got a problem. And I'm quite sure that's what it came down to. But I just want to say that I'm a little bummed out. It's like Harvey Dent said in Batman, you either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain. And I got to say, I've just always loved John Stockton. And so it's one of those things like, man, come on, John, not this. Oh, man.
Yep. G and Ursula at 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. Thanks, G.
Take care, guys.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Let's get back in touch with Dr. Keith Jerome, the director of the University of Washington Virology Lab. And I saw this piece in the Wall Street Journal, which says that thanks to Omicron, a lot of people could end up with what's being called super immunity. And it almost implied that Omicron is like a vaccination. So can you explain this concept of super immunity?
Well, I can try. I'll start out by saying, Dave, I don't really like the term super immunity. It's, you know, it's not a very precise term, and it sort of brings up images of superheroes and being invincible. Basically, it's saying that Omicron can sort of act as a booster. Mm-hmm. So we have a pretty good, what we call a full vaccination rate in our state, 70% or something. But the number of people who've actually gotten that third, the booster, is lower. And essentially getting Omicron is sort of acting like that, if you will. It's bumping the antibodies up so that people are more protected. Doesn't mean you're invincible. Doesn't mean that if a new variant comes along, we can guarantee you won't get it. But it does make you less likely to get a future infection. And of course, people who have been vaccinated typically have a mild case of Omicron. So it is kind of more like when you get the vaccine. If you get a vaccine, right, you maybe feel a little off the next day, but you sure don't end up in the hospital, right? Mm-hmm. So, this is happening on the backs to some degree of the folks who've decided not to get their vaccines. If Omicron is the first time you've seen, if you haven't gotten a vaccine, you haven't had COVID before, Omicron is actually pretty bad. You can end up in the hospital and you're 20 times as likely to die. And we're starting to move toward, we're not talking about those folks anymore. And boy, it's a shame. The country's seeing 2,000 deaths a day, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the feeling is, you made your choice, you take the consequences. But I'm concerned that people will look at this Wall Street Journal headline and figure, oh, maybe we should have an Omicron party. So I want to be clear what this actually means. You're saying that this so-called super immunity is conferred on people who've already been vaccinated and end up with Omicron.
Yeah, exactly. So if Omicron's the first, again, if it's the first time you've ever seen any COVID, you haven't gotten it, you haven't got vaccinated, it's going to give you some immunity for next time. But we know that a single bout of COVID isn't all that good at protecting you from the next one. Remember all those stories back in 2020, right? Oh my God, somebody caught COVID twice, made the news at the time. Well, now we know it can happen. And wow, that's a tough way to build up immunity to Omicron. You're going to be sick. If you're lucky, you won't end up in the hospital. If you're unlucky, you will. And like I said, people are dying of this. And that's a tough way to build up immunity when there's a simple shot in the arm you could get.
Okay, now I also saw a piece, I guess this was out of Great Britain, about an Omicron sub-variant. Is there such a thing?
Yeah, there is. And we're following this really closely. There's something called BA2. So the Omicron we sort of think of is BA1. And it's unclear whether one came from the other or they sort of co-evolved. That's getting figured out. But BA2 was kind of first started to get in substantial numbers in India and the Philippines. And now we're seeing it grow in Europe in places like Denmark, the UK, and Germany. And we've seen it here. So it seems to be growing. The general sense is that BA2 is probably even a tad more infectious than BA1. So it will probably become the predominant version of Omicron. No evidence right now that it's any more severe. So that's good news. But this is a super infectious virus that's growing to be more infectious. And there's every chance that this is sort of the pathway toward getting to what we call an endemic state where we all kind of live with this because everybody's had the vaccine or a couple of bouts of infection, and even the people who decided to not get the vaccine now have their immunity if they survived the infection. So where life gets a little bit back to normal, that's certainly possible. But I do think that the people who are declaring the end is nigh in a good way, I think that might be a little premature. I hope it's true, but I think we can't be sure yet.
Well, even if you're mildly superstitious, it's a bad idea because
Declare success.
Yeah, exactly. So everybody's going to be getting tests pretty soon, looks like, because they're being ordered and mailed out. As a virologist, what is the best way to use these tests? Should we be all testing ourselves on a regular basis, or do you wait until you feel a sniffle? What's the best, most efficient use of these home tests?
Yeah, well, you get, I think, 4, right? I put my order in, they haven't come yet. 4 is tough. It's not a great number to use. So a good use for sure, if you have symptoms, maybe you've been exposed or you're in a high-risk situation, taking the test, particularly if you can't get into one of the places to get the PCR. They've been really busy, right? It's hard to get an appointment. That's a great use of the tests. People are using them before gatherings. Be careful about that. The rapid tests in particular aren't perfect. No laboratory test is perfect. And, I work in laboratories, and I will tell you, we make them as perfect as we can, but they're not. And so don't be sure that everybody's safe. And you keep hearing these stories, right? Oh, we all took the antigen test and then we had our big family gathering and we all got COVID. Well, that's because they're not perfect. Generally, we recommend if you're really trying to be as sure as you can that you aren't carrying the virus because you're going to get together with someone, you need to do sort of two tests a day apart. And that helps them be a little more accurate. Still not perfect, but substantially better. So this is going to help a little bit. More tests are better than none, but we really need even more tests than that for them to make, I think, a big difference.
And what's the current prediction in terms of the modeling on when we stop seeing these big peaks?
Well, the idea is that the Omicron peak is probably passed in many parts of the country. I think we're maybe seeing a turn here. Our positivity rates in UW medicine virology are still over 30%, which is unprecedented in any other wave. So there's still a lot to go in this. And then some of the predictions say this is going to drop off and we're going to start to move toward this level of endemicity. I think that that could certainly happen. I also know that biology is always hard to predict. And somewhere in the world, there may be somebody with a smoldering long-term infection who's developing some new variant that we're just not aware of yet. And that's the sort of thing that keeps me up awake at night. And that's why we need to have as many people protected as we possibly can because of the unknown.
Well, we need to find that person and quarantine them right away.
Well, we're getting better and better at finding these variants early, right? This BA2, we have found it early and we're tracking it. And it gets us in this awkward situation of finding these variants. And then, you know, people like you ask us, what do we know about them? And the answer is not much yet because we're studying them. But it's better than being completely in the dark.
Yeah. Dr. Keith Jerome, director of the UW Virology Lab. Dr. Jerome, thanks very much.
All right. Take care, Dave. You can ring my
bell. Ring the bell. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And Rachel Bell has been following the great resignation. People who decided to take this job and shove it because they want a job that they can love. So what was the common denominator here, Rachel?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about this a little more because I interviewed so many people and, you know, in commercial radio, we're trying to stuff everything into 5 minutes. You know, the common denominator was that people wanted more respect. They wanted to make more money, but that was not the priority. They just didn't want to feel overworked. They wanted a better work-life balance. And for a lot of industries, they felt like right now the employee is in charge and, you know, they have a greater advantage to find a new job. And so a lot of people are leaving without another job in place. But there are some people who aren't going back to work at all. So I spoke with Ian Cook. He's vice president of analytics at Visier. It's a company that for the past 5 years, they have collected data from about 9 million employees at a bunch of Fortune 500 companies. So it's not like workers are taking a survey about whether they've left or not. This is like the actual data. And he said that since the pandemic started, there are 2 million people who have left work, but they are not coming back. So those are either people who retired early or there's a lot of women who stopped going to work so that they can be stay-at-home moms. He said this is impacting the market greatly. So I think everybody at this point has heard that restaurants are having a really hard time hiring people. You know, I know there's a pizza place down the street from me that's now paying $20 an hour and they still can't get any help. Wow. And this is what Ian has to say about that. Why retail and restaurant may not go back to normal.
So there's a statistic called labor participation rate. So how many people in our total population are actually in work? That is lower by about 2 million people than it was pre-pandemic. I don't know that those people are coming back to work. That means we will be in a tight labor market, price escalation. So I think areas like retail and healthcare are going to have long-term challenges. You know, we may end up shopping in a metaverse as opposed to going to a shop. So, you know, your avatar walks into Name Your Brand and you are given a digital representation of yourself in the product, which then gets delivered.
I didn't include it in this clip, but I yelled, no, after he said that. That makes me so scared. I don't want to live in a metaverse.
No, but that's the new thing. That's what Facebook is now. We're all going to be little avatars in this three-dimensional thing. We'll be walking around wearing goggles all the time. So that's too bad. There's no way to make some of these jobs more attractive, huh? Besides just the money.
one of the things he was saying was, yeah, he said, well, obviously the money isn't working, you know, and a lot of people, they think, who have left restaurants and who have left retail have, you know, gone to a totally different profession or they're becoming entrepreneurs. But he said you might have to appeal to people at an emotional level. So, you know, if you have a restaurant and you want people to work and you're already offering a lot of money, kind of appeal to like, hey, you know, do you want to work for a legacy company? Like this pizza place down the street is actually a restaurant that's been written up in all these national magazines, kind of appealing to people in that way. Like, do you want to keep this restaurant around? Putting an emotional component, you know, where are your values? Do your values line up with us? This is a really great place to work. You'll like the people here, like kind of appealing to people in that way. But there was a woman that I interviewed in the story you may have heard yesterday. Her name's Laurel Whitley, and she worked in restaurants for 10, 15 years and decided to leave because she wasn't feeling respected. And what she says here is a big part of why I think a lot of people might be leaving.
The customer is not always right. And I know that that's very controversial. It has become the gold standard to suck up to every single customer, no matter what. These service workers need to be treated like people. You know, hopefully this newer generation of people will not put up with it.
You know, she talks about the fact that people will complain and complain. You know, there's a short staff right now, so people will be told you have a 40-minute wait, and they agree to that, but then they're upset that they're waiting 40 minutes still. And then if they complain enough, the manager will give them a gift card to apologize for it. And it kind of just starts this cycle of the customer thinking that they can behave any way that they want. And so that's, I think, a big reason why people aren't interested anymore. And then I read a story in NPR that was saying, you know, we shouldn't call it the great resignation, we should call it the great renegotiation, because that is what it is in a lot of cases, whether it's people who are about to leave their jobs, but they have all this leverage because so many coworkers are leaving that they end up staying and they do get a raise and they do, you know, get the permission to work from home permanently or whatever they want. But they also say that, quote, data from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta shows that job switchers are getting significantly faster pay increases than people who stay in their jobs. So people have leverage right now. They know they can go out there and get something better.
Yeah, but it sounds like part of the problem is lousy customers. So people who want their restaurants to come back may have to check their own behavior.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, like she said, you know, it's the customer is not always right. And so maybe there will have to be a cultural shift. I don't know how you do that. You know, like when people are, I think it's getting worse that people are used to getting what they want, because I've talked about this before, you know, with Amazon, you can get something delivered to your door within hours. People are just used to getting things how they want it. And so, yeah, there needs to be a cultural politeness that needs to sweep the nation to keep servers wanting to work at restaurants.
Or else we just have to let more immigrants in.
I mean, you're right. That's something that I've always said is people who are anti-immigrant and saying they're taking our jobs, they're actually doing the jobs that a lot of people who are born in this country don't want to do.
Yep, exactly. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.